It was 1965, I believe June or July. I was a photographic technician with a background in electronics. The organization that I was in was a brand new installation. I was in a color lab one day when my boss, Staff Sergeant Taylor, came over to me and said that they were having a problem with some equipment on the base. It was the Lunar Orbiter program, where their mission was to locate the first landing sites for the 1969 lunar mission for the astronauts. Since our equipment was similar, he asked me to go over to the NSA facility and take a look. At the time, I didn't know what NSA was. I was pretty naive. I thought he said NASA. So in my mind, for a long time, I thought it was a NASA facility that I had gone to. The facility was on Langley Air Force Base, where the NSA was bringing in the information from the lunar orbiter. I packed some tools and went over where a couple of officers took me into a very large hangar and a laboratory. There was an airman second class in the dot. I was an airman second class as well. He turned the equipment on and put it through its paces. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. And I saw what was going on with it. I said to him, "We'll have to take this thing out of the lab. I can't work on it here in the dark room environment." It was about the size of a small apartment refrigerator, not easily moved. So he called someone to get some people to come in and move it. Everyone left the dark room except this airman second class and me. While we were waiting, I asked him how they got the images from the lunar orbiter to the laboratory. He went through the process, describing how the various radio telescopes around the world were linked and they telemetered the data into Langley Field. At the time, I didn't know what the real purpose of the darkroom or this operation and the facility was. I thought this was where they were bringing the data in and then releasing the images to the public. I had no idea that there were other issues involved. He starts telling me all of this information, and I knew that what we were doing was classified and that he could only share a certain level of what he was doing with me, because of the compartmentalized nature of our jobs. At any rate, he told me how everything worked. He showed me the equipment where the digital information came in, where it was converted to photographic images. They were doing 35mm strips of film at that time, which were then assembled into 18 by 11 inch mosaics. There was a digital signature and a grayscale on every 35mm strip, and those strips were from successive passes around the moon. They would take and build up a photograph. They would scan one section of the moon and then another and another, and then they would get a larger image. So this mosaic then would be put in that contact printer and printed. As he was showing me how all this worked, he said, "By the way, we've discovered a base on the backside of the moon." I said, "Whose? What do you mean, whose?" At that moment, I realized what he was saying and I became a little terrified, thinking to myself that if anybody walks into the room right now, we're both in trouble, because he shouldn't be giving me this information and I shouldn't be listening to it. He pulled out one of these mosaics and showed me this base on the moon. In the particular shot I saw, there were several buildings clustered over a fairly large landscape. There was one structure that had a dish-like shape to it, but it was a building. There was another building near it with an angular top that was truncated. There were towers, there were spherical buildings, and there were very tall towers and things that looked somewhat like radar dishes. Some of the buildings were very tall, thin structures. I don't know how tall they were, but they must be very tall. They were angular shots with shadows. There were spherical and domed buildings that were very large. They stood out very clearly. They were large objects. It's interesting because I tried to relate them in my own mind to structures here on Earth, and they don't compare to anything that you see here in scale and structure. They're similar to a degree. I tried to relate them to metal structures and I couldn't see a metal definition. They're more like a fabricated stone. Some of the buildings seemed to have very reflective surfaces on them. A couple of structures that I saw reminded me of cooling towers at power generating plants. They had that sort of a shape. Some of them were just very straight and tall with a flat top. Some of them were round, some looked like a Quonset hut, with a dome, like a greenhouse. I didn't want to look at it any longer than that, because I felt that my life was in jeopardy. Do you understand what I'm saying? I would have loved to have looked at it longer, I would have loved to have had copies, but I knew I couldn't. I knew the young fellow who was sharing this was really, really overstepping his bounds at that point. Testimonial. Donna Hare had a secret clearance while working for NASA contractor, Philco Ford. From 1970 to 1971, I worked in Building 8 of NASA for a contractor, Philco Ford. I worked in the photo lab and in different areas of the company on and off site. On one occasion I entered the NASA photo lab in one of the restricted areas. I had a secret clearance. Where they developed the film from the moon and satellite pictures. One of the techs I had been friends with drew my attention to an area of this mosaic which was several panels put together to form a larger picture. They were satellite pictures. Aerial shots looking down. I commented that they were interesting. With a smile on his face he said, "Look over there." In one of the photo panels I saw a round white dot. It was very crisp, with very sharp lines on it. I asked, "What is that? Is that a dot on the emulsion?" He's grinning and says, "Dots on the emulsion don't leave round shadows on the ground." I looked and there was a round shadow at the correct angle with the sun shining on the trees. I looked at him and I was pretty startled because I had worked out there several years and had never seen anything like this, never heard of anything like this. And I said, "Is this a UFO?" And he's smiling at me and he says, "I can't tell you that." What I knew he meant was, it was a UFO but he couldn't tell me it was a UFO. I asked him what he was going to do with this information. He said, "Well, we always have to airbrush them out before we sell them to the public." And I was just amazed that they had a protocol in place for getting rid of UFO pictures on these things. I also met a security guard that was forced to burn a lot of UFO pictures. He came into my office and he was very frightened. He said, "Donna, I heard you were interested in this subject. I used to work out there. And one day some soldiers came in fatigues and had me burn pictures." He said that he was burning them and he was forced not to look at them. But he was tempted. He looked at one of them and it was a UFO on the ground. Shortly thereafter he was hit in the head with the butt of a gun and he still had a scar on his forehead. Now, this gentleman, he was scared out of his mind. And he said that in the picture was a UFO with little bumps on it. It looked like it had just landed. It's very hard knowing about this. But again, I have talked, and the people that know about it, know about it. It's like a little underground. They will come to me and talk to me in private. Most of them are very afraid. I guess I'm not afraid because I wasn't debriefed. There was a point in time when I had some people come out and tell me I shouldn't talk about this. They didn't threaten to kill me but I got the message. And like I said at there, (1997 Xeti, congressional briefings), I really started feeling like this topic was like sex. You know, everybody knew about it but nobody talks about it in mixed company. I'm waiting to tell more whenever there's a congressional hearing where I could be protected. I want it to come out when it's necessary and proper and can do some good. I don't want people going around that are trying to get rid of these people or hurting them or challenging them or making them so frightened they move away, like this one particular man I know of who has just disappeared off the face of the earth. This particular man used to be in quarantine with the astronauts returning from space. He was part of their debriefing. He told me a lot of the astronauts talked about their lunar landing experiences, seeing these ET craft follow them. I believe there were three on the moon when they landed. And I think that the code word for these ET craft was Santa Claus. He said that the astronauts who wanted to talk were threatened. They'd signed papers not to talk. They would have their retirements taken away. I was just overwhelmed with that piece of information, so I started asking questions. Certain people that I knew were key people in the organization, so I'd talk to them away from the site. We'd go to lunch and alone they would tell me things and then swear if I ever said they said it, they would say I was lying. The one gentleman that I knew very well who was in quarantine with the astronauts told me the 80 craft were on the moon at the time of the Apollo 11 landing. This man has disappeared off the face of the earth. I've tried to find him, but I only have his name. What's going on is a belief that you can manipulate communicable trust between the leadership and the led. The way you do that is you don't let the press in anywhere. Access to war is extremely limited. The fiercer the combat, the more the access is limited, parenthesis, including, access to information. This is a direct contradiction of the stated policy of maximum access to information consistent with national security. There was a time in South Africa when people would put flaming tires around people's necks if they dissented. In some ways the fear, parenthesis, now in the US, is that you will have a flaming tire of lack of patriotism put around your neck. That fear keeps journalists from asking the tough questions. I am humbled to say, I do not accept myself from this criticism. Dan Rather, CBS News. Multiple Emmy Awards exclusive testimony, Richard Doty Special Agent, AFOSI. Richard Doty was a special agent for counterintelligence for the Air Force Office of Special Investigations, AFOSI. For over 8 years he was specifically tasked with the UFO/extraterrestrial issue at Kirkland Air Force Base in New Mexico and also at Nellis Air Force Base, the so-called Area 51, and at other locations. In July of 2016, Dr. Greer met Richard Doty in Albuquerque, New Mexico for an explosive and revealing 3-hour interview where Doty confirmed the existence of a false flag operation regarding UFOs. See Part 4. The corruption of the media, the U.S. government's responsibility for civilian injuries in the famous Cash Landrum UFO case, and much more. My name is Richard Doty. I was assigned as a special agent with Air Force Office of Special Investigations at Kirkland Air Force Base from 1979 through 1986. I was a counterintelligence officer at the time. I was briefed into a special access program involving the U.S. government's investigation and contact with extraterrestrials, the visitation of these extraterrestrials to Earth, and the Air Force's involvement with these extraterrestrials. During this time my primary mission, probably 60% of my time dealt with that. The Defense Intelligence Agency was intimately involved in it. Everything that we sent up to OC headquarters went to Dyer and a guy by the name of Tom Mack. Tom Mack was the manager for Dyer on this project. I was read into the project in the summer of 1979. It was a special access program and I had to have special security clearance to have access to it. I was briefed into it by an Air Force colonel from Washington. I want to leave his name out of it. The code name was Yankee Black. That was the program's briefing. It wasn't necessarily the UFOs program, it was actually a security code for an access program. Yankee White was access to the White House. And Yankee Black was the access you'd have to get into this program or get read into this program. The briefing started with a history of the US involvement with extraterrestrials. There were 4 types of crafts that they briefed us on and 4 types of extraterrestrials. They never explained where the photos of these extraterrestrials came from. One ET species looked like an insect. It had huge eyes, a very large head, and a small body. It had 2 different appendages, parenthesis, hands, on their arms and several joints in their legs, and they had a bubble-type appendage in the front and a lump or something in the back. They were about the size of an average adult human, between 5 and 6 feet tall. The second ET was a very tall, thin humanoid with long arms that reached down to its knees, or halfway between their hips and their feet. They had regular hands. Their faces were very thin and almost human-looking and they had no hair. Except for the cat-like irises, you'd have to be up close to realize they weren't human. The third creature looked something like the Ebon, parenthesis, see secret file, Roswell, FBI document, only it had a larger body. I found out later in a 1985 briefing that it was a genetically engineered creature that the Ebon had made. As for the craft, one was cigar-shaped, approximately 60 to 70 feet long and 20 to 30 feet wide. Then there was a saucer-shaped craft, only it was really wide, almost like one of those tops that the kids play with. I remember a colonel saying in the briefing that they still couldn't figure out how this thing flew. They took pictures of it, observed it, but I don't know if they ever actually downed one. The third kind of vessel was oval-shaped, about the size of a Volkswagen. It was almost like an Eben craft, only a lot smaller. It was a one-seater, maybe an observation or reconnaissance craft. The last ship looked exactly like the McMinnville craft, parenthesis, see McMinnville UFO in photo section. There were photos of these creatures and the crafts in the film. It didn't have a date on it, it started out in the 1940s or 1950s, but as the briefing went on, it became more modern. Sandia was doing a lot of R&D related to the extraterrestrial technologies. A cylinder on the Eben craft had been analyzed at various locations, and Sandia had it, parenthesis, Sandia National Laboratories is part of Lockheed Martin. S.G. In 1984, President Reagan came to Sandia and was going to be specifically briefed on this. I happened to be part of the security detail and I was in the room when they were explaining this to him. They had cutouts of it, and the presentation on the overhead projector, and they were explaining to the president what they thought these things did. It was a multi-purpose avionics device that was also a navigation device for them. One of the members of our former intelligence group was a Secret Service agent for some years, and then he went over to the CIA. And he told us that one of the most fascinating things about Reagan was that, when he took office on January 20, 1981, he immediately asked for a briefing. He said, "I want to be briefed on everything we have on UFOs." I went to Washington to get an award for something I did which is still somewhat classified. And I met the president. I had never talked to him about the subject, but he knew something because he said to me, "I know you work on some very interesting things out there." He gave me presidential cufflinks. I knew what he was talking about, even though he never actually said anything. It was important for me to know that what I was doing was being briefed all the way up. The other political figure that had knowledge of the subject who I met was Claiborne Bell. He was a senator out of Rhode Island, and he and his aide were independently briefed into the program. He was chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee from 1987 to 1995. He and I had a casual conversation about the subject at a party, and he acknowledged knowing something. Regarding other men in the secret UFO projects who might be willing to talk now, perhaps Hal Puthoff, Kit Green, Paul McGovern and Carl Dale. Carl Dale was in DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency. He was a case reviewer for UFO projects and UFO investigations. And he used to come to the meetings. Our former intelligence officer meetings, and he told us about a time in the early 1970s when they chased an ET around and tried to capture it in the Virginia, Washington DC area. It was quite a fascinating story about what happened. I had been told something about it by former CIA Director Richard Helms, who in fact, is a real Falcon. It's been out on the internet some time now. I was always friends with him. I don't know why, he just took me under his wing. My dad knew him years ago, and Richard Helms is one great guy of course. He passed away several years ago. But he told me a lot of things. He was involved in the subject. He knew things that I would be. It would make my hair stand up. About things he'd seen and done. I was involved with the Germans on this subject when I was stationed in Germany. The BND, parenthesis, Bundesnachrichtendienst, is the German equivalent to the CIA. There was one particular incident that happened around a nuclear weapons storage area where something entered it, cut a fence, got in. But didn't actually get into a bunker. There is a depository of information and extraterrestrial artifacts at Fort Belvoir in Virginia and at the Naval Observatory underground at what they call the CIA off-site location in McLean, Virginia. Then there's Los Alamos. I was there once in the early 1980s, Nothing to do with UFOs, but the security officer that was taking me around for another investigation I was doing pointed to this area and said, "That's where we have all the UFO stuff." Bechtel Corporation was in charge of security and operations at a number of facilities, including the Nevada test site. One of their chief security officers was a former colleague of mine who worked with me at Kirtland. And Bechtel was involved with a lot of experiments regarding alien technology and reverse engineering done at the Nevada test site, which is now the Nevada National Security Site. I was briefed into a counterintelligence project in the early 1980s. Operation Pyramid, I think it was called. Sandia Labs had a project funding a study into time travel. Whether you could go back in time or go forward in time. And they built facilities out there to test different things. They were using huge magnets in an underground facility and were shooting lasers and things through them, trying to open up the fabric of space in order to do time travel. I don't know what the outcome of it was. I don't know if they ever figured it out or not. They were also doing experiments in teleportation, moving across space in a non-linear way. They teleported something from one end of the table to the other. Maybe they did more, I just wasn't aware of it. I actually saw a craft flying above Groom Lake that did things that you couldn't do with a conventional aircraft. Flying 1400 miles an hour and stopping, changing angles, and then going straight up and stopping, and coming back down. And this was a big aircraft. This was one of these oval-shaped alien crafts that they were testing out there. And this was in 1987. Common sense tells you it can't be a conventional craft, it has to be anti-gravity or something, otherwise it would kill the pilot. I had a pilot standing next to me who had been a fighter pilot for years. He flew F-106s, and told me, "There's no way in the world a pilot could have survived that." He said, "Accelerating isn't bad, but you gotta stop. When you stop, the G-forces will break your body to pieces." Cash Landrum ARV incident. I met the four Air Force pilots involved in the Cash Landrum incident in 1980. It involved an extraterrestrial craft that we had reverse engineered. And I know that for a fact, parenthesis, the Cash Landrum UFO incident. SG. On December 29, 1980 at approximately 9 p.m, Betty Cash, age 51, Vicky Landrum, age 57, and Colby Landrum, Vicky's 7-year-old grandson, were driving home to Dayton, Texas on an isolated 2-lane road in dense woods. The witnesses reported seeing a bright light above some trees, which they initially thought was an airplane approaching Houston International Airport. Moving closer, they realized the light was coming from a huge diamond-shaped object which hovered about treetop level. The object's base was expelling flames and emitting significant heat. Cash and Landrum got out of the car to examine the object. Colby was terrified, and Landrum quickly returned while Cash remained outside the car. The witnesses later described the object to be shaped like a huge upright diamond about the size of a water tower with a flat top and bottom. Small blue lights ringed the center. Flames periodically shot out of the bottom, flaring outward, creating the effect of a large cone. Every time the fire dissipated, the UFO floated a few feet downwards toward the road. But when the flames blasted out again, the object rose. The witnesses said the heat was strong enough to make the car's metal body painful to touch. Cash said she had to use her coat to protect her hand from being burnt when she finally re-entered the car. When she touched the car's dashboard, Vicky Landrum's hand pressed into the softened vinyl, leaving an imprint that was evident weeks later. Investigators cited this handprint as proof of the witnesses' accounts. The object ascended over the treetops where it was surrounded by 23 tandem rotor CH-47 Chinook military helicopters. All three witnesses experienced symptoms associated with radiation sickness, with Cash having several extended hospital stays. Eventually, Cash and Landrum filed a complaint with the Judge Advocate Claims Office at Bergstrom Air Force Base. A U.S. district court judge dismissed their case, noting that the plaintiffs had not proven that the helicopters were associated with the U.S. government. Military officials testified that the United States Armed Forces did not have a large diamond-shaped aircraft in their possession. The reverse-engineered craft was one of those big ones. It was not saucer-shaped, it was more of a huge oval shape. There were four members of the crew. The two pilots, a systems officer that was handling the equipment, and the navigator. They had trained for 9 months before they ever flew it. And then they trained another 4 or 5 months, flying it all around Nevada. And it worked fine. The problem was that they couldn't manipulate it the way they needed to for a human pilot to fly it. Instead of an ET propulsion system, zero-point energy, they put one of our nuclear propulsion systems in it. The ARV took off just fine from Nevada, and it flew perfectly. They were going to an air base in Texas. I think it was Webb Air Force Base in Big Springs. The pilot told me they were flying at a high altitude. No problems whatsoever, until they slowed down. Then all hell broke loose. The system malfunctioned and they had this, something that was supposed to throw thrust, but the thruster was moving all around. And they had some kind of filter that didn't work. It was just a mess. When they cut power, so many things went wrong they almost crashed. They called for rescue helicopters. The craft spurted radiation on those people. The pilots finally got it going again, and they landed it someplace. Then they flew it back to Nevada. None of the pilots suffered any radiation problems. It was just those poor civilians on the ground who suffered terribly. The Benwitz affair. One of the security officers from Sandia Laboratories. They had their own security. Was driving around on the graveyard shift after 2 o'clock in the morning and saw an ET craft land at a bunker. When it landed, all the electronics in the vehicle shut off. His engine, his portable radio, and the radio in the vehicle. All for as long as that craft was on the ground. When it took off, everything came back on. I was called in to investigate to see if something had actually landed. It wasn't on base radar. The first thing I did was check with FAR. At that time we had a pretty secretive unit that scanned every single radio frequency that could possibly be generated in and around the base. I obtained the printouts and asked if any strange frequencies were detected in this particular time frame. But again found nothing. I interviewed the security police inside Manzano separately, but they repeated the exact same story. Shortly after that, Major Ernie Edwards, who was the commander of the 1608 Security Police Squadron which guarded Manzano, came to me and said, "I received a phone call from a guy by the name of Paul Benwitz. He lives right outside the base in Four Hills, a housing community just on the other side of the base perimeter. He claims to have seen all sorts of strange lights from Manzano." I found out Paul Benwitz owned a business. Thunder Scientific Laboratories. Located right outside Kirkland's main gate. They made humidity sensors for submarines. So he had a government contract and security clearance. I paid him a visit. His house was literally just a few feet from the base perimeter. His backyard butted right up to the fence. He was a physicist and had all this sophisticated equipment on his patio, and his upper bedroom patio faced the base. I asked him what he saw, and he started telling me all sorts of UFO stories. We decided to conduct an investigation on him, not only us, but the NSA, because he seemed to know about a National Security Agency project that was going on at the base, which he shouldn't have been able to figure out, but he did. Very smart guy. One night Jerry Miller, a scientist on the intelligence staff at Kirtland, Steve Atzer, another agent, and I were invited over to Paul Benwitz's home for dinner. We were having coffee when suddenly I saw this orb appear in the corner of the room. I elbowed Jerry as this orb started flying around the room. When Paul saw it, he matter-of-factly said, "Well, there it is." At first, Jerry thought Paul had generated it. It was a ball of light with little sparkles around it. But Jerry checked all around, with Paul's permission, and could not figure out a way Paul could have generated it. Paul said, "Those are the aliens. That's their reconnaissance. That's how they keep an eye on me." Parenthesis, SETI has had many similar orb events occur. SG. A few weeks later, we were in Paul's house alone.